You know, I really liked your presentation, Michael, because we're really transcending the name, shame, blame, guilt trip situation, and we're starting to figure out how to do things that are positive. And I think that's the most important thing. So first I want to ask is, Agam, you've heard this discussion today, right? I guess this isn't the standard awareness trip in Surat, right? But would you consider that the issue of ethics or whatever could be incorporated as part of the manufacturing process? Is it possible? Are we talking here some American fairyland and it's surrounded, they would look at us like we're totally weird? Or do you think this could be integrated into the diamond manufacturing process in a place like Surat?
No, since we have started to believe that we are one of the major stakeholders of the industry, and we have been acting a lot more responsible since what you could see India doing a decade ago. And we learned a lot of lessons from this various compliance systems like BPP and RJC and all those sort of things, which was just a starting point to how we can restructure our industry, the recruitment, how we can formalize it. You know, there was all floating recruitment before. You know, workers hops from one factory to another, and they don't have any sort of rights as such. But things have completely changed now, and they are changing every day. But that was all local. That was under our control. That was something which we were directly connected to. And people from Indian industry were two steps or probably even more further away from the mining situations. It's the first time that now Indian manufacturers would go to the mining companies and deal directly with them. So I think it's a much bigger subject for Indian industry to handle right now. They are still not as mature. They have been trying to do what is just, but to understand the whole situation from not just the consumer point of view, but from the politics point of view, from other point of views, is still very complicated for them. But they are trying their best. I think if I have to say for our company that is gonna be starting sourcing from Zimbabwe probably, we want to have the best ethical practices in place. It is very clear. We don't want anyone to point finger at us and tell us that what you are doing is unethical, is harming someone's life, is hurting someone, and you are indirectly associated with rape, murder, and all those sort of things. We don't want those sort of accusations.
Okay. So, Roy, assume for a minute that the stuff that Michael's talking about could be worked out somehow with a place like Surat. Do you think this ethical stuff is going to fly from a consumer perspective in the reasonably near-term future? Or are we just getting on the surfboard 3 years too early and making all this certification stuff and then the consumer doesn't really give a damn?
Different people have different motives for buying. And so to say everybody cares is wrong, and to say nobody cares is wrong. But when you say, okay, what would work best? I think the underlying question is, how do we get people on board with buying ethically produced products? And the answer is, very simply, if you show them the good that this company is doing, because you bought this from this company, you helped make this happen. And they have to understand at a very visceral level, not a philosophical level, but you have to have faces. You have to say, this school got built. This clean water came to this village. You know, this clinic, this hospital got built because this company put a fair trade manufacturing plant or fair trade mine or whatever in this town, and you're supplying jobs for people that would not otherwise have jobs. People will respond to that. People will respond to that. But if you give them this overarching philosophical talk that we've had today, you'll get a glazed stare because, as you pointed out, Peter, they got too many other things to think about. They just, too many other things to think about.
Annabelle, the stuff that you guys do you also do the positive I imagine you get these reports out there and, oh, De Beers says they're doing everything wonderful, so you put it up on your website. But does your website have any positive impact when people do the right thing? Do you give out, like, you know, little gold stars for, like, in kindergarten? Or, you know, is there any way that you could also rank or rate or communicate the good stuff the companies are doing as well? And is there any measurable benefit to that?
Certainly. I think the reputation factor plays both ways. So companies often come to us and said, we really appreciate the fact that you're highlighting the positive steps we're doing as well. For example, the way that De Beers was addressing the AIDS issue. And there are all kinds of... Sorry, is that better? there are various benefits for that. I mean, it's good PR for De Beers. It makes people have more faith in the impact of, you know, the mines that they're sourcing from. But then it's also a good example that other companies can then follow. So in terms of just having the good examples out there, it makes it a lot easier then to go to other companies and say, okay, well, look, this is what De Beers is doing on HIV/AIDS. How about talking with them? How about getting some of the ideas from how they're doing it too? So I think the recognition works both ways. Companies, you know, don't like to be seen in a negative light, but obviously the more information that's out there, the better. And in terms of our website, it does reach an influential audience now, so it's being looked at by mainstream investors, by social investors, by the business media increasingly. So obviously it's in companies' interests to have that information out there.
So like you're saying, therefore, that social responsibility could be seen as an added value component to a product. I mean, that's what we're kind of thinking here. And that different NGOs could take a proactive role. Actually, you know, instead of being negative, they're positive, and so you actually make money instead of losing money. I mean, that's your point, Michael, of course. I want to ask you, Peter. Peter, you know, I don't know these ethicists. I mean, if you guys were like dentists or accountants or lawyers or, I don't know, media consultants, you'd get out there and we could use you more. But it looks to me like if what Roy was saying is correct, ethics is going to play an important role in product development, like design does, or like, you know, whatever it is. So, you know, you got this great iPad, everybody loves it because it looks so cool, and you might have this great jewelry that, you know, it's really cool because it's got the stamp. But is there any connectivity between the kind of stuff that ethicists are doing, or are they all hiding in the little holes? I mean, do they interface with people like Michael? Michael, I want to ask Peter first, but you may not know, but I would be looking to the ethicists and saying that they should play a leading role in interacting with certification systems as some kind of a neutral, you know, force to kind of help resolve some of these most complicated issues. But where are ethicists? Are they just kind of doing their own thing or what?
Well, part of the problem is that a lot of them were trained in universities. They have PhDs in things like philosophy, and people who go into philosophy aren't necessarily the people who are going to be at their marketing themselves either to the companies that might want to use them or, for that matter, to the general public. And they're generally not going to be particularly skilled in the sort of things that Roy talked about, that is focusing on the little sandbite that is actually going to influence the consumer. So I think that there is a sort of occupational problem with a lot of those in my field. But I'd say increasingly there are more who are prepared to get out there and actually relate to the public. It's been coming slowly, but we have associations for applied and professional ethics, for example, which somewhat separate those who are more interested in that applied area than those who are interested only in writing in academic journals where they'll be read by 35 of their closest colleagues.
So Michael, is there a role here? I mean, I think your presentation was great, by the way. Do we ever clap for Michael? Do we give him a proper... You know?
Thank you.
I think it was really important because it really shines a light on the way forward. But when you establish these standards, and you've done it, and other industries have established them, so obviously it's something that works. Do you think that, first of all, do you interface with ethics people so that there's some standard there, or is it just kind of an adversarial relationship between NGOs and trade, and they're all fighting, and you give me, I'll give you, and that's it? Or is there some common ground where everybody kind of kicks back and says, you know, we're doing something good over here and stuff? And do you think there's a role for ethicists in the establishment of these standards?
Well, I think the first thing we have to recognize is that many of the NGOs that become the public face of civil society preferences are, in a sense, an embodiment of ethics. You know, we don't want our environment to be destroyed the way it's being destroyed. We don't want to see people's lives being destroyed because of deforestation or removal so that they can open a mine underneath their homes. And there are common civil society values that get reflected in NGOs. NGOs can't raise the money that they need if they're not reflecting a broad civil society consensus. And I think that Roy's point that, you know, this particular pendulum swing that we're on right now is one which is rich with ethical implications, as opposed to the other pendulum swing when it's the me, 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 I don't care what's going on outside there. Whether we can find a directory of ethicists to call on to see whether the debate between do we go after the tar sands of Canada or the oil drilling in another place in New York, and which one has the worst impacts, and what about the challenges we make to companies? Are they ethical challenges that we're making? I don't know of many NGOs that have retained ethicists on a contract to check their work on a regular basis. But I think it's also a question of not having a sort of a professional ethicist community to whom to turn, other than our favorite former university professor of ethics that we always go back to or send an email to when there's a dilemma that comes along.
So my concern only here was that, you know, some people look at NGOs as these are just opportunistic kids who have an idealistic 60s pendulum swing, you know, and they're sort of like, you know, they're interested in themselves. So they can get a sensationalist story screwing some company and go to some Soros guy who'll give them $10 million. Hey, that's cool. We won. I mean, there's a real question from the industry's perspective, you know, that everybody's in it for themselves because it's sort of like this adversarial relationship. So what I'm wondering is, in the case of the jewelry industry, if it wouldn't be possible to find some common ground where we kind of get rid of the adversarial. It's an adversarial process. I understand you go to court and there's a defensive attorney and there's a prosecuting attorney and you have it out and theoretically some truth emerges. But what I'm thinking is that the current scenario that I see tends to be adversarial of negotiations. So you got these guys in Africa, they're getting screwed. You get these two white guys in London negotiating over what they think is best. And it's kind of a business deal. And then if they all decide everything's cool, they do this way or that way. And what I'm trying to say, and I know there's stakeholder development issues here, but I'm just trying to wonder is, do you think, you know, the diamond and jewelry industry could, in effect, you know, create some kind of a standard that transcended that kind of an adversarial relationship?
Yes, but first I'm going to call you on your characterization of the NGOs as being kids that are just out there to get a thrill out of doing that.
I'm just needling you a little here, you know.
You know, the people that I've seen working in the Center for Business and Human Rights, the Business Human Rights Resource Center, the people working at Rainforest Action Network, the people working at Forest Ethics are really dedicated, hardworking people working at one-third of the salary that they could earn out in industry because they're committed to that particular cause. So I've got to get away from your stereotype of what they are. I think, in fact, what we're finding is, as that one slide of mine suggested, more and more companies are finding these NGOs as delivery partners. They're finding that if they approach them, as Tiffany approached Earthworks, a group on whose board I serve, which is a mining-focused NGO, and says, help us create an ethical certification system for mining before we become the target of the groups that are targeting other industries. And that set the process in motion. And that, I think, was sort of a tipping point in the relationship between NGOs and businesses, because now you have more and more sectors where the businesses are saying, let's find someone who will work with us to develop a certification system to help solve the ethical problems we have in our supply chains.
So this is great. So basically, there's an evolutionary process that has taken place over the last 10 years. The NGOs are getting much more sophisticated and mature in a certain way, and also they're looking in a positive way in terms of having a proactive, positive relationship with industry when and if industry is ready. And industry should wake up to that fact, because some people were stuck in the past. They go, oh, NGO evil, that's it, you know, bad kids, etc. That's why I reflected it this way, because I think there's a lot of people in the industry, and maybe even in India, who have a very knee-jerk reaction to this whole process of interaction on these issues. And so they immediately shy away because they say, hey, this is a no-win situation. How are you ever going to sit down with these guys and get somewhere? And I think the message coming from you today, Michael, is that no, that's not true. The NGOs are interested in proactive, positive dialogue that can add value to companies if the companies, in fact, you know, would do that. I mean, Annabelle, is that what you see? Would you agree with that?
I completely agree with that. I think it's partly a question of desired outcomes as well, and sort of a shift in recognition as to what, you know, as businesses do we want to do, and seeing NGOs as partners in achieving that. So I thought the example Peter gave of the guy at Revlon, who then at the end of his career looked back and said, oh, the most satisfying thing for me was actually that we developed this new way of testing. It's sort of individuals within businesses saying, oh, what kind of business do I want to be running, and how can I work with others to get there? And I think NGOs are very open to do that. You know, ultimately, it's a question of shared goals at the end.
So right, this kumbaya thingy, right, this new movement, et cetera, is that going to bring NGOs and business and everybody together, or are there fault lines in this?
No, what's interesting about this is the idealist era, the 60s. They have these beautiful dreams, but they never actually take real action. And some questions were asked earlier, and I should have made it more clear. The pendulum doesn't refer to small groups of individuals. There will always be a small counter movement to anything that's happening. It refers to the masses. It refers to the large, you know, when a song becomes a hit song, what is it we're agreeing on exactly? But this vast number of people agree simultaneously they love this song. Nobody's sure what that criteria is. So the idealist era is when everybody's looking out for themselves and they're wanting freedom of expression and individuality, and they'll create all kinds of do-good organizations that won't actually do a lot. Now, in a civic era, people don't talk so much as they do. Don't tell me what you believe. Show me. Do something. Talk is cheap. Now, I have a question. I have a question for the industry. Most industries typically respond to crisis. They'll have this meeting. Everybody has this conversation. Wouldn't it be good if? Maybe we should do this. Maybe we will. And they talk it to death. Okay, I got a real simple marketing solution for you. Diamonds and gold, particularly engagement rings, probably more susceptible to a devastating attack than any other product on earth. Because you're only buying it as a symbol of something pure and good. That would be so easily tainted. Okay? All I have to do is calculate how many people have had hands and feet cut off because they weren't digging fast enough. And just equate it into all the engagement rings. Every fifth of a carat was somebody's finger. A full carat was a hand. For 3 carats, someone died. And by the way, if you got a gold mounting and it's solid gold, somebody died from cyanide poisoning. Have a good wedding. Now, what happens is, real easy to sell that. It's very sensational. So here's the question. Does the industry want to wait until after they have the problem? Because all it takes is one journalist out to make a name for themselves. And let's just pray to God that journalist is not watching the streaming video right now. Because this would be very, very, very easily done, unbelievably easily done, ambush journalism and to destroy an industry rather permanently when it comes to engagement rings in America. And then we would really have to depend on India and China to buy all this stuff.
Yeah, I think your point is very correct. And you may want to relate to this, but we are at risk. We know that. And I think that that's one of the motivating factors, although maybe a more important motivating factor is that we're good people and we want to be good people. Like, you know, the guy who, after all those years, said that I had a good, you know, I was very happy that I did this thing. So let's look at that. We've got reputational risk on this side. I guess it has some economic value. You have sitting in this audience quietly some of the largest companies and some of the most important people in the diamond and jewelry industry, and I'm sure there were 600 and some people watching. So I think that people are aware of this and concerned about it and recognize that reputational risk factor. And I guess it's going to be every man from himself. We had a meeting and we did talk, and it kind of evolved to every man by himself in one of our little NGO meetings. But you realize what's going on here in terms of this stuff. Do you think that that risk would be reasonably assessed by the Indian community? You're going to go back to Surat in a little while. You're going to be married soon, right? He's getting married soon, you know. He's going to have a couple of weeks. All right.
Thank you.
And I want to tell you, when I met with him and his wife in Mumbai, before we invited him to come out here, so she was so into this, man. Like, we were talking, and she was like, whoa, totally into the social responsibility concept. And to that, you said we shouldn't stigmatize anyone who says, oh, they're Indians, they don't care this thing. So do you think that this point that is coming up here can be, you know, fairly reflected? Not as a threat, but as an opportunity to say, hey, if we do our stuff, man, you know, we could really avoid evil and get into a good scenario. You think there's a chance? I know you said before,
See, back then, it's difficult, but... No, not just that. I mean, even when we talk about the awareness within the trade in India, it's very little. When we talk about the Zimbabwe situation or any other things, they are not so well exposed to the issues and the risk involved. There's this limited authority, the council knows about what are the threats, the people who travel, they know, probably the site holders know, but that is just a very limited people. They actually has any sort of capability of assessing or addressing this sort of risk and threats.
All right, I think it's a process, and I think it's a thing. I'd like to ask some really difficult questions, and maybe questions that don't have any answers, and that's okay too. Let's look at the situation in Zimbabwe today, as far as I can tell. And it's totally not clear. First of all, we should understand there's 700 or 800,000 cutters in India. You're talking about millions of carats. You're talking about relatively inexpensive diamonds, which gives a tremendous amount of work. It's just fantastic. I mean, I have reports of about 200, maybe 250,000 people, say 200,000 or 150,000, being able to live off the Marenge diamonds. Yeah. So that's an employment opportunity for these people. There are two mines in Zimbabwe right now, the Cannadil mine and the Mabada mine, which people are going to buy the diamonds from. And we don't know. These mines have been put together by people, and there is no real reports of severe human rights abuses at those mines right now. The outlying area is controlled by military, and there are problems of forced servitude and other problems there. I spoke to Farai Maguwu about 10 days ago, and I asked him, are there human rights? He says, yes, there are human rights in the area. I said, are there human, and he's the leading guy that you would ask these questions. And then I said, are there human rights abuses in the Mabada and the Cannadil? He says, we don't know. We're not allowed into the area. But I have reports that I hired my own people to snoop around. They wouldn't let them into the area. But frankly, there is no clear indication. I don't even think, rationally, if I had to do a gambling bet, I would pretty much assume that in the Mabada and the Cannadil specific mines, there's probably no human rights abuses of the nature that they're talking about. Now, so we have a situation, and then, the money, though, is going, so when you buy, if you buy diamonds from Mabada and Cannadil, the money is going to these people who are on the OFAC list, who are on the Office of Foreign Asset Control, the United States government, et cetera, say don't deal with these people because they are undermining the rule of democracy or whatever happened. Now, ethically, what do we do? Now, it's easy to say don't buy the diamonds, but maybe the diamonds are mixed. Maybe the solution is to get to the Surat community and say, please don't mix these two diamonds, is what I've been asking, because it's illegal to buy these diamonds in India and you can't stop the people from working.
That is impossible.
It's impossible not to mix the diamonds.
Yes.
I don't think anything's impossible if the buyers say we don't want them.
No, I'll tell you this way.
What's your perspective?
Let's talk logistics.
Let's talk
How it is practically impossible.
Yeah, right.
See, if a diamond is large enough, then traceability is all feasible. You can do it. Okay, up to 30 points, I believe. Maybe a few other better qualities, yes. But what if you are dealing with 5-point diamonds? There is an order of 10,000 carats of same sieve, same size, same quality. No factory in the world can produce the identical goods to finish that order. Those diamonds are traded. They are mixed with various parcels. They are separated from various parcels. At 10, 15 different stages, it goes around 15, 20 hands before it reaches the jewelry manufacturer to finish his order. Now, how is someone, if I take an order stating that, okay, I'll only use, let's say, the Canadian diamonds and not Zimbabwe diamonds. I can't entirely finish my order just by sourcing from limited places or just by sourcing from my own factory. I need to go out to the open market to finish that jewelry order.
Okay, well, I think that, well, first of all, I understand your point.
Yeah.
But I think it's an economic issue. I mean, look, I go to India.
Yeah.
And I'm kosher, so I'm veggie. And it's amazing. In India, you know, they actually keep separate pots and stuff. It's amazing. And you're Jane, right? So you don't, okay, you're like a little, he's cool Jane. He eats potatoes and onions. Ooh, okay. That's his, but he's really, this guy's careful about what he eats, okay? And so is Peter as well, you know. But the bottom line here is that there is a capability to keep veggie restaurants and non-veggie restaurants. I think people are very capable of doing that in India, even though there's a lot of mixing in the kitchens. But my bigger point to you is I think it's an economic thing, because if people said in America, let's assume that America has a risk component, and let's assume that there's a legal issue or not, but there's definitely a reputational risk component. So if someone would go to you and say, I'll give you more for this ring, but make sure that in this ring, you're only sourcing the five pointers from factories, or keep it separate, like the kitchens.
You expect 10,000 manufacturers, probably another 3,000 diamond traders, to keep their inventory separately?
No, I expect that you'll give the business to five manufacturers who have the guts
but
and the brains to separate them. It's like eating food. You expect every restaurant.
But those five manufacturers won't be able to fulfill an order.
Okay, so then it's a question of, okay, so Michael, what do we do? I hear your point. I'm not attacking you at all.
I think
it's really important to recognize the positive role that India plays and the fact that to do something here, we really have to work together. And it's not going to come from blaming or you're this or that. But I understand your point is, realistically speaking, from a manufacturing perspective, asking to separate the merengue goods sounds really weird to you, very difficult. And Michael, so what do you think? What do we do with this?
In almost every sector where an ethical certification system requiring traceability has been created, the first response of the companies was, we can't do it. It's absolutely impossible to do it. And it's not just the major companies like Home Depot said, we can't tell for sure whether our wood is coming from an FSC-certified forest or from an old-growth area that should be conserved. But within 1 year, they created a system in which now they can tell you where every stick of wood comes from, right down to about a 100-square-meter plot in whichever forest it was. Starbucks said, we can't really trace our coffee back past the port out of which it came. But with the pressure to separate fair trade coffee from conventional coffee, it now knows where every bag of coffee it buys comes from, right down to the actual farm, which may only be 2 acres that it actually came from. And in the case of the producers themselves, a situation much more sympathetic or similar to Surat, there are Ethiopian coffee farms and coffee cooperatives that have 100,000 small farmers, and they have learned to keep track of which bag of coffee comes from which farmer and which of those farmers are fair trade certified and which ones are not, so that there's a traceability through the entire system right down to the cup of coffee at Starbucks. And it can be done without a great deal of cost, but it always looks impossible to begin with. And I've read about Surat, and I understand the difficulty of the problem.
What you've been talking about is, you know, a linear flow wherein, you know, a product is going from one hand to another, but it is not being mixed or assorted with any other products. What I'm talking about is, when you manufacture in a factory, you get all sieves, all sizes, all colors, all clarities, and you have to assort them. And when you get an order, you only have an order for particular assortment. So basically what happens is, you have to go to 15, 20, or maybe hundreds of manufacturers, which you can't do. So you go to a trader who sources from those 100 manufacturers. He keeps those qualities separately. In case of wood, you don't look at a shade of a wood which is being ordered. You know, it is dealt in a commodity way. Mm-hmm. Diamonds are not dealt that way.
I'm sympathetic to the problem, but I'm not convinced that it can't be solved.
Let me say this. Let's assume if I gave you $1,000 a carat instead of $200, you'd figure out a way to do it. Okay? So I think that it's a question of money. And I think that what you may want to see, for example, take Tiffany. For some reason, Tiffany sources their diamonds. I understand they have complete control of their supply chain. They made a deal with Ellendale. They get their yellow diamonds from one mine. They know where every diamond comes from.
Now, they know the factory, but they don't know the end source.
No, yeah, they do. It means you can, let me just say this.
How would they certify it?
Forget about their certification today. I'm talking about what they're doing today. They can say to you that this diamond engagement ring comes from this rough that came from this Canadian mine or this Australian mine or whatever it is. Now, that's an expensive proposition. And I'm not saying that everybody everywhere wants this kind of level. Not everybody is a veggie. Not everybody wants to pay for this. So you're saying that it didn't appear to, there was this perception of very high cost initially by fisheries and timber and other industries. And somehow, Michael, you felt that it was possible to do in a reasonable way. And I understand your feeling is, hey, this is crazy. You don't know Surat. There's mixing, there's sieving, there's remixing, there's 300 dealers, there's goods flowing and coming and going and everything else. And I understand your point as well. And that's why these are sometimes contentious and questionable issues. But I'm trying to get to Susan Jacques at this. Susan, you out there, Susan? Tell us, Susan, from a retailer perspective, weighing some reputational risk, understanding that it must cost more. But even before I ask you, tell me this. How much more is all this goody stuff worth? I mean, if I'm going to go to the problem and the trouble of trying to separate all this stuff, do you think you can get higher prices for this stuff? Is there justification? Is there economic justification for this stuff?
Virtually every one of the systems that I discussed up there get premium prices. And the premium prices go from, 2 to 4% for 2x4s in wood to 100% for teak, which is FSC certified, to 10% for fair trade bananas over conventional bananas, 15% for fair trade coffee over conventional coffee. Okay. Significant premiums to cover the cost.
Okay, now, Susan, you're in the jewelry business, right? And does this stuff make any sense in terms of the, would there be a premium? Do you think that this stuff's worth more if we're avoiding reputational risk going on?
Thanks for putting me on the spot, Martin.
Give the light. Give him more light.
Don't give me more light. This is a matter that's very near and dear to my
heart. You're from Zimbabwe, but she
is born and raised in Zimbabwe.
She was born in Zimbabwe. So this isn't just putting anybody on the spot. Okay,
I was born and raised in Zimbabwe, and this is something that I take very, very seriously. We as a company, Borsheims in Omaha, have chosen not to accept Marenge goods. And we have now pushed back down through the supply chain, asking every single one of our vendors who supplies any diamond product, could it be watch companies with diamond bezels, loose diamond goods, that we do not wish to have Marenge goods in our store. I can only influence the sphere of influence that I have, and that's a small sphere. And I do get a lot of pushback from the diamond suppliers saying, but you don't understand how it all works. You don't understand that these are all mixed. And my response to them is, you need to understand, I as the client do not wish these goods in my store. Therefore, you need to push back to your suppliers to inform them to fulfill our orders, we don't want Marenge goods. At this time, I think these are a hot potato that the American consuming market, and that's the only market I'm aware of, I'm not in the global consuming market, it has huge potential to once again create a devastating situation within the jewelry and diamond industry. Different than what we occurred with the conflict diamond issue in the early 2000s. Because now we're sitting also in a recession, depression, with a very limited amount of money that people are willing to put into jewelry anyway. And if that iPad just becomes that much more appealing, because I don't possibly want to own a piece of jewelry that in some way could have impacted the lives of these folks, that's very, very detrimental to our business and to the business of almost everybody in this room. I have another reputational risk in that our company is owned by Berkshire Hathaway. So we are a company that, again, has somewhat of a spotlight that sort of hangs over all 76 companies. Warren Buffett is a legendary investor who always talks about doing the right thing. And to us, we're willing to do whatever we need to do to make sure that we do the right thing. So I would beg of you in Surat, as you come up with these fabulous new training centers, these manufacturing processing centers, to step out of the norm and do the right thing by keeping the Marenge goods separated. There will be a market for Marenge goods, but in my opinion, at this time, it's not the American market. I'm sure the Chinese market and the Indian market at this time may not have the same social responsibility concerns that the American market does. But I do expect everybody that signs that letter for me to be truthfully signing that letter with transparency and pushing back to their vendors. I had a huge site holder call me when he got my letter. And he said, this is just, it's impossible, Susan. I can't do this for you. And I said, that's going to make it really tough for me to continue to do business with you. And so we feel that as a small single store in Omaha, Nebraska, we're not a behemoth giant in the jewelry industry. I can only react to the situation by doing the best that I believe we can do. I want my staff to be able to answer the questions when the consuming public comes in and asks, what are you doing about this? That there is something we have done about it. I don't want to be, once again, in the retroactive action of trying to deal with it. I want to be proactive in dealing with it. I also ask that hopefully within our sphere of influence, we can influence others to do what I believe to be the right thing. And until Zimbabwe has a regime change and a change of situation, those are not goods. I do not want to any further provide access of financial means to Mugabe and his henchmen. I really don't. You know, they've destroyed the homeland that I always hoped to return to.
We should give her a round of applause for that principled position.
I think I understand your pragmatic position. And I think that it's very important for Indians to understand.
Excuse me.
Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, Martin.
Please.
I have two questions for Michael Conroy and for Peter Singer.
Can you just give me 1 minute and I promise we'll give you the two questions.
Okay.
I just want to finish one point here.
Okay.
I want you to understand this, though, that, you know, it's weird because there's some kind of an uneven kiboshing, whacking going on. You're out there in Surat, and you're dealing with a lot of people and issues, and there's so much good that you can do with your purchasing power in Zimbabwe. We're talking about that as well. And I honestly believe that I spoke to the chairman who was just the day before he left to Zimbabwe, and he said to me, tell us what to do, we'll do it, we'll send inspectors. And you know, there's a tremendous amount of goodwill by the Indian community to use their purchasing power to impact what's going on in Zimbabwe and to do monitoring, et cetera. And I think that we're going to follow up on that. But I want you to understand that what's disassociated here. When Susan sits in her store and someone comes in and says, I read this thing about Zimbabwe, or maybe the Internal Revenue Service comes in and says, we are now implementing OFAC regulations. And she's got to answer that consumer. You don't see the consumer. You're hiding in India. You're not at the front line on this kind of a reputational risk thing. Okay? You really aren't. But she is, and maybe other retailers are. And maybe there is no one good way here. Maybe there is no solution. But what I think rationally we should expect is a certain bifurcation of markets. Maybe it's only 10 stores in America that are like Susan. Maybe there's 100. Maybe there's 1,000. But I would expect that there's going to be some separation of markets. Some people saying, we don't care. We, you know, we're just legal. And some people saying, I really want to make sure that my diamonds are not from there. And then I think that the way it works is that we go to the suppliers and say, do you want to supply me? If you don't want to supply me, mix the goods. You want to supply me? Separate the goods. I'm a veggie. You want me to eat in your restaurant? Separate your dishes. You can't separate your dishes? But I don't think there should be a guilt trip here necessarily.
No.
And I think what Michael is saying is, we have markets. And I spoke to Stephen Lussier about this just a week ago or so, and he was saying to me the same thing, that it's a business. Business will take care of the issue if there's demand, if Susan pays a higher price. I imagine Susan gets a higher price. So I think that we have to realize the fact that there's going to be separations of markets and that we can't all have the same standard, et cetera.
See, higher price or not, I mean, we are here to do what is right, okay? And if we can, if it is within our reach to make it possible to separate two goods, we would do it. But if you expect me to finish an order and not source it from outside, it is impossible. If I go outside, I can't take guarantee of what is happening over there.
I understand. Okay. Maybe we'll have to come up with a system that there's a group of people that are all veggie restaurants or veggie suppliers. I don't know. Let me say this. I want to get to that question too. But I think that we should just be realistic. We can't expect Surat to turn on a dime. And we have to recognize that 700,000 people or 200,000 people need to feed their children and need to eat. At the same time, we have to recognize significant reputational risk is there. And we have to recognize that companies are responsible for their actions. And they're going to do what they want to do to protect their self-interests. And this will all work out, and I believe, in what we call the market space. How much will Susan pay for the goods? How much do you want to supply? How much does your competitor want to supply? Maybe there'll be a couple of suppliers in Surat that will say, we have a new policy, we're in a separate area or whatever, we don't source outside, I don't know. Maybe we'll have the whatever groups there are. And by the way, it's not just Marenghi. There might be questions about higher levels of certification. But I want to go back. Excuse me for not taking your question That's before. Okay. So, and I think it's good for questions to come from outside.
That's okay. I have just two questions. The first question for Michael Conroy. 2 years ago, I did attend the transfer event. And in that event, Estelle Levine did propose the sustainability report. And you answered part of that question in your presentation, but I also wanted to find out where you stand with the sustainability report right now.
Very briefly, thank you for the question. Estelle Levine was a fabulous consultant who did a feasibility study that was designed primarily to meet the internal questions of the fair trade movement about whether this was a product and a supply chain that we could realistically and credibly certify as fair trade. So her report, which is designed to meet the requirements of the fair trade movement, was not designed to meet the general interest that businesses might have in potentially engaging with it. So it's never been converted into the kind of thing that you would like to see. My colleague Maya Spall is in the room here, and she is what we nobly call the director of new category innovation at Fairtrade USA, and maybe Maya could give a better answer, if you allow us to,
sure,
on the status of the diamonds process.
Thanks, Michael. Where we are now, you know, it's really, when we're building these new categories, it's really difficult to bring, you know, to bring products to market without sound industry partners, but without a certification system to propose to them. Again, people are not sort of, you know, it's sort of like a cart before the horse situation. So I think we're just at a little bit of a standstill, wanting to move the project forward. And again, as Michael mentioned, it's really about funding. But we're at a space and a time now where I think having industry members talk to us, to myself, to Michael directly, and show interest and build it collaboratively, I think would be really great. So that's really where we are. But we need to have something a little bit more tangible, I think, to propose before we can bring it on a large scale to the industry.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Go ahead, Rob. Can someone get Rob a mic? But if you're going to give me this long speech about, you know, politicizing and smiling, I'm just going to, you know, make believe you're not here. It's short and to the point.
Yeah.
Okay.
For Peter Singer, you did mention somewhat boycotting diamonds, and I wanted to just ask you if you really think that that's a solution, because in my opinion, I think that in some ways, you know, there are really harsh conditions at the mines. However, if those people are not paid at all, or if there's no demand for the diamonds, then have we successfully, has we been successful in achieving anything by boycotting diamonds?
Well, the question always is, if something wrong is happening, how can you put pressure on those who are doing it to stop? So if, for example, some of these diamonds are coming that are unethical, that is going to damage the image of diamonds as a whole. And people do have choices, right? I mean, at least in jewelry, they don't have to wear jewelry with diamonds. It may be traditional for engagement rings, but, you know, you can put other gemstones in there. So I think that's something the diamond industry might have to face, that people will turn away from diamonds because of, you know, it's the rotten apple syndrome. If there's some rotten apples in the barrel, people are going to avoid the whole barrel. So I think that is a possibility, and that is what might lead to the pressure to have the separate streams, so people can say, look, I can still have a diamond engagement ring and I can know that it did not come from a diamond that was involved in human rights abuses or where the people of the country got no benefit from the fact that diamonds were being mined.
Okay. Rob?
I have a question for Michael. You mentioned, I don't want to oversimplify what you said, but you said you think that a lot of these issues could be kind of laid to rest in 2 years. What would you kind of, if you kind of ran the diamond industry, if you had advice for the diamond industry, what kind of specific roadmap would you give to go forward to kind of lay some of these issues to rest?
Very, very simply, one thing I forgot to mention is that the RJC, Responsible Jewelry Council, is present on this IRMA project that is beginning to pick out commodities. I think if there were clear support from the diamond industry to move forward with the pilot testing of the standards around diamonds, that would accelerate the process for implementing standards for diamonds and give a greater likelihood of having this sort of thing finished. But the roadmap is really to get the standards finished, put them out for general consultation, revise them on the basis of the consultation, do a pilot testing of the standards on the ground, create the verification mechanism, and then launch the system. And that can be done in 2 years. It's been done more rapidly than that.
And just one more question. You talked about the Forest Stewardship Council, which I guess is considered a successful thing. What kind of things do you think that they do differently that you say that perhaps the Kimberley process isn't doing and that current systems in the diamond industry aren't doing?
Number one, the Forest Stewardship Council is radically transparent. Every decision it makes is communicated to all of its members. Number two, it is radically democratic in that it has three chambers, an economic chamber, a social chamber, and an environmental chamber, and no major change in the system can be implemented without a majority of each of those chambers. And that means that the NGOs who are participating in it cannot force new regulations on the industry because the industry has a veto power over it. So all of the standards have been negotiated in this context of balanced stakeholder participation. And so that it is seen as being an incredibly effective way for channeling the NGO business negotiations about how to improve continually the standards being applied in the case of forestry. And I think we haven't had a process quite that way, except for the IRMA process, which is a small-scale, slow-moving process along the same line.
So we'll take one more question. So are we good till 6:10 or so? 5:10, I mean. 5:10, 5:15? Like. All right, so let's get a question, and then we'll have to, you know, do that. Go ahead, please.
Okay. In the law of unintended consequences, anyone who wants to jump in and answer this, as we're hopefully moving toward some type of transparent certification system, that will be drawing attention to all the stones that aren't certified, and how would the industry deal with the question of, well, gee, what happens with those stones? And then also in another law of unintended consequences, does that open up the channel for synthetic stones, particularly the small sizes that are currently commercially available?
Well, I'll just relate that. No problem. You got fair trade coffee, non-fair trade coffee at Starbucks, and everybody's doing fine, and you've got excellent cuts and very good cuts in diamonds. So there'll be different people who have different size, you know, scale desires. So I don't think that's going to be a huge problem for the rest of the diamonds. They'll trade at a price that reflects their added value-ness or lack thereof. In terms of cubic zirconia, I think it's great. You know, anything, you know, Swarovski seems to be doing pretty well. So I don't think that there's evil for the jewelry industry to sell. What? Yeah, it's all fine. All products are good as long as they're honestly reflected and represented. And it might, in fact, you know, encourage. Right now you have marketing. If you go on the internet and you say, you know, Blood Diamond or something, you're going to get an ad from some of these companies selling, buy synthetic diamonds. That's the solution. So I'm just thinking it's a marketplace. And I think that people will protect themselves by having differentiated products. I mean, Michael, you laid that out pretty well. You know, so I think we're, you know, pretty good. Any last statement from everybody? Anybody want to say anything in closer here? And Amber, we're going to want a picture of us at the end of this. Yeah, go ahead.
One quick comment on NGOs that I sort of feel I left hanging, and I think this definitely is a movement to collaboration, but I just wanted to highlight the work. I know you've had Human Rights Watch here in the past, but obviously the whole Morangi issue wouldn't have come to light if it wasn't for the Zimbabwean NGOs highlighting it, and then Human Rights highlighting, leading to your decision not to source from there. So collaboration is fabulous. There's also the need for the watchdogs, and there always will be.
Yeah, we want to remember. And like I said earlier, Farai Maguwu was just, the courts today decided that Farai Maguwu is not, there was no reason to hassle him. And so he's freed today of all these legal things. And, you know, that's a good step in the right direction. And I invited Farai to come to this conference. But unfortunately, he couldn't make it because they wouldn't give him his passport back. But apparently they'll give it to him for the KP, so that's good. But okay, I want to thank everybody here. I want to especially thank our speakers, many of whom flew on their own dime, okay? And we thank you all very, very much. Thank you for attending. And goodbye to everybody on the internet. We love you.